Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. I thought today that we might talk a little bit about the two big boys over in the East, India and China, and a little bit about where they're both at and where they may be likely to come in conflict with each other. Jim, we've been pumping out a lot of copy lately on China, I've noticed, and it seems like there's a lot of activity in China, especially in trying to build up their military. What exactly is happening there?
Well, they have two problems. One, their military is still fairly antique. You know, a lot of Cold War relics. The second problem they have is corruption in the military, where a lot of money simply goes missing, or, you know, a lot of it that is spent on weapons actually ends up in somebody's Swiss bank account. So they keep that quiet as much as possible. But in absolute terms, they are making progress. They are replacing a lot of their old Cold War, you know, era equipment. They are, however, finding that a lot of the new stuff, which much of it they buy themselves or get from Russia, is still not where they would like it to be as far as capabilities go. And the Chinese are very frank about this. We've run several pieces based upon interviews with senior Chinese officers admitting that they simply haven't got the manufacturing or design capabilities yet to match the world-class weapons. But, as we point out, they are, year by year, decade by decade especially, making progress. They are catching up. Let me put it this way. They haven't quite caught up to the Russians yet. There, where Russian technology was circa 1970s. But 20 years ago, they were back in the 1950s. I think one piece, I haven't got the numbers right in front of me. When the communists took over in China, there was basically no real military equipment and weapons industry at all. All their modern weapons at the time, in late 1940s, were imported from somewhere else. And it wasn't until the 1950s that they even began building, you know, licensed copies of Russian equipment. And they didn't really get into high gear until the 70s and 80s, in terms of being able to manufacture, again, under license, legal license with Russian advisors in some cases. In the first cases, they made deals with Stalin in the 50s, and they imported entire Russian factories with Russian, workers and supervisors and technicians to build them and to train the Chinese on how to run them. So they've come a long way. And the thing you have to keep in mind is that year by year, they close the gap. And our prediction, the latest one, I believe I have to sit down and do some math to create these. Another 20 or 30 years, they'll be very close, if not even, with the Western United States European technology. I expect they'll pass the Russians in 10, 15 years, because the Russians simply haven't got the money, they haven't got the economy, to keep up. What really has kept the Russians going and developing military equipment, and they haven't made that much progress since the end of the Cold War, are sales of ships and warplanes to China. So China is the next Soviet Union.
Now, how they've been investing a lot in relationships in Africa, is that because of a limit of resources?
Well, China has not got a lot of raw materials. They import, for example, most of their iron ore from Australia and a lot of other, ores, as it were, because Australia is a big place And in the outback, the middle, which is mostly desert, there's a lot of valuable stuff there, which you can dig out with, you know, at low cost and ship it off to China. That's why the Australian economy has been booming for the last 20 or 30 years. Africa, on the other hand, also has a lot of these minerals, but it also has certain rare minerals which are found in abundance in Africa but are extremely rare in the rest of the world. So China is simply competing. Now, where China gets criticized is that a lot of the illegal money, like in Congo, and Austin can give more detail on this, the people who are facilitating all this illegal mining are the Chinese. They're doing it very quietly. If you accuse them, they'll deny it. They'll say, prove it. And if you do that, they'll change the subject. But they are the bad guys there because they need it. They know where it is. They went and get it and got it.
Austin, on how is China's African connection affecting the politics there in Africa?
Well, that's an extremely complex issue. It's got a lot of dimensions. It's one is how is it affecting China in the world? Also, how China is no longer the Maoist state it was, perceived as something of a rebel or a third world leader. They're now at least at the economic level a something of a new type of imperial exploiter. That's not the way the Chinese wanted their policies to be perceived, but they've got a problem, and I'll just use some of the language that Jim has used in the past in talking about some of the dilemmas that China faces. China knows that they've made the economic deal with their people, and the economic deal is, and I'm here in China, I'm talking about the Beijing government, the Communist Party, which still runs China, is we're going to let you get rich. You're going to get the material goodies that you want. You're going to have smartphones, just as long as you don't criticize us too much. You can have smartphones. You can have television sets. Heavens, you'll even be able to travel and go in and visit foreign countries. You're going to be able to enjoy the fruits of modernity. But the deal with that is they got to keep that economic engine not only going, but expanding. And that means access to resources. And, of course, they're in the same situation as any modern industrial, any modern economic power, because you just can't just call them an industrialized. They're an information power as well. So they have to get active in the world, in the global economy to and assure access to resources. Now, in the past, China's been able to say, hey, we're not the United States. We're not France and Great Britain. We're not Russia. We're something else. And in other words, we're somebody you can do business with because we've been victims of the imperialists as well. Well, that was something of a facade, but now it's that self-portrayal has been ripped to shreds, particularly in Sudan. Part of the deal was coming from China, and here's the cynical component of it was. We're not going to try to get into your local politics. It's just going to be about money, and you'll settle things yourselves. And of course, that says the dictators in China. If the dictator in Sudan is allowing them to develop the resources and get the in Sudan's case access to the oil fields, they're not going to say much of anything. But, of course, the world is very complicated and choices get made. And part of the thing that China was doing in Sudan, and I'll use Sudan as kind of a case study. You can see it replicated in other places throughout Africa, is that, we'll sell you weapons. We'll give you weapons, too, because part of the deal is that the government, Sudanese government is backing you. You've got to support them. And then there's the issue of Darfur, Dan. and the genocide in Darfur. That put China in an uncomfortable position, a very uncomfortable position. And then the civil war going on with the South. And finally, there's the independence movement in the South. Of course, the North in Sudan, Khartoum government says it's a secessionist movement. Well, now there are two separate states. And the predominant, the 75% of the oil fields are in South Sudan. And the South Sudanese have they got a chip on their shoulder in some ways about China, because the Chinese provided weapons and certainly political support to their opponents in Khartoum. So now China's in something of a fix. China still wants to talk money, and China is trying desperately to China's actually a mediating force in some ways between South Sudan and Sudan, because it wants to get its money back out of the development it's put into the oil fields, but it also wants to assure access to the oil. Now, some things that Jim mentioned, I'll just quickly hit. He's talking about Congo. China worked one of the more interesting economic resource deals. Some people call it a grab. When they essentially told the Congolese government, and I'm talking about Democratic Republic of Congo and Kinshasa, we'll provide you up to $10 billion worth of infrastructure development. But in exchange for this, we want you to guarantee that we have access to certain strategic minerals that the Congo possesses. Now, as Jim can tell you, that includes things like tantalum, which is plays a major role in high-tech electronics. But that's not the only thing. There's copper resources, cobalt. The Congo is really literally a gold mine, because there's gold resources as well. So they were going to, this $10 billion was to put in roads, electrification. We're going to help you with development. A lot of the Congolese, particularly Congolese political opposition, says this is just a sellout to the current Kabila government. Why, we're not even getting jobs out of this, because the Chinese insisted, for the most part, I think there's been some give since the initial announcement, that it was going to be Chinese workers coming in and doing all the work. That's something else that Chinese seed into their contracts, and that creates local resentment. Anyway, that's one of the things that China's done, and it's put them in right into the mess of local, regional, tribal, and national politics, national conflicts in sub-Saharan Africa.
Jim, now India has been building up their military too, but they seem to be making the mistake of buying junk from the Russians quite a bit. They seem to have the articles that I have seen up there is that they've had a lot of problems with some of their military equipment recently.
Well, they have two problems. One, yes, they've been buying from the Russians for over 50 years now. That dates back to the 60s when the Indians decided to become neutral, or as they call it, unaligned. And part of that was buying everything from the Russians. The second problem is there's always been enormous corruption in the Indian military procurement system. I mean, it's epic. It's worse than in China. A lot of money was wasted. But the problem they have now is that China has a bigger GDP, and the Chinese defense spending is three times India's. And so China is adding more high-tech equipment than the Indians are, because they have more money to spend. The Chinese equipment, the Russian knockoffs that China makes, are not failures. They just miss, they're a little less polished. They might not have a few features that the Russians have. But in combat, they'd be virtually indistinguishable from the Russian stuff. India and China have some of the same Russian combat aircraft. The Su-30 is popular in both countries. So the China basically has more money. They're both doing the same thing, but China is basically outspending India. It's as simple as that.
Now, they've had some problems in the Navy there in India recently with some of the ships and also some leadership problems, right?
Well, the Indians have an advantage in that they have been at sea, as it were, on the high seas longer than the Chinese. But at the same time, India always had a reputation, you know, and Western officers and NCOs, chiefs who have gone over to India for joint training or to help train the Indians or for whatever reason as tourists, they always noticed that the Indian ships were, you know, they tried to be up to the Western standard, but they were a little sloppier. Again, there was the corruption problem. But in this case, they're not at a big disadvantage to the Chinese because the Chinese have only in the last decade started to send their ships to sea a lot. The Indians have always been doing that. Even if the Indians, you know, ran their ships down, the sailors were experienced. And that is still the case. But what makes India nervous is the fact that, A, the Indian Ocean has become a primary trading route for imports and exports for China. So it's the Indian Ocean is essential for China. As a corollary of that, the Chinese are sending their ships out onto the high seas a lot more. And a lot of that activity is, and this really bothers the Indians because they really can't complain too much, is 5 years ago, the Chinese started contributing ships to the anti-piracy task force, the International Anti-Piracy Task Force, that was operating off Somalia. And they've spent about 10,000 Chinese sailors, I estimate, have made that 4,000-month, you know, deployment, you know, traveling out there, spending 3 months. And now what they're doing is visiting various ports, you know, before they return. So they add a little diplomacy, you know, to the actual operational training they're getting out on the high seas, you know, chasing down pirates and what have you. So the Indians grit their teeth and, you know, have to get used to the fact that the Chinese are in the Indian Ocean all the time. To make matters worse, and we just did a piece on this recently, the Chinese, without much fanfare, have established unofficial naval bases all through the Indian Ocean. The article was published, you know, this week. It was called the String of Pearls. They have bases in Burma, in Bangladesh, the Sri Lanka, and now they are building the largest port in Tanzania, the largest port in Africa. This is being primarily in support of all the mining and resource extraction they're doing in Africa. Africa is short of ports, so the Chinese are simply going to build it. Now, the Chinese will point out that none of these, especially the one up in Pakistan, all of these are commercial operations, which they are. Chinese firms are going in. They're spending billions. They're spending $10 billion alone on the African port, which will literally be a new port outside Dar es Salaam. They're spending billions of dollars. They're basically for commercial, you know, sending in Chinese exports and taking out, you know, goods, usually raw materials, from the host country. But when you have that sort of relationship, how much of a problem is it going to be to ask them, by the way, could we send in some of our warships to pick up supplies, a little shore leave, maybe some light repairs? Not too many people are going to say no. In fact, politicians in all those countries have basically said when asked by journalists, well, why not? So China is very stealthily establishing a string of naval bases all the way from Burma through Sri Lanka, surrounding India, in Pakistan, and out to East Africa. And the Indians have nothing like that. So all the more reason for India to be nervous. Now, China is not really gearing up for a fight, but if there was some problem in the Indian Ocean, and the Indians are very well aware of this. The Chinese are getting ready. Now, at the same time, on the positive side, China in the last year has backed away from the claims it was making on half-century-old territorial disputes with India. China has always claimed a large chunk of Northeast India is actually part of Tibet. Now, we've written about this several times. I'm not going to go into it here. But the fact of the matter is, all of a sudden, about 2 years ago, the Chinese started, shouting it from the rooftops. Hey, you're occupying our land. Maybe you should move. And at the same time, the Indians got alarmed. So they took a closer look and they said, oh, my God, the Chinese have built all these roads on their side of the border. And this is a godforsaken, mountainous, we're talking the eastern, edge of the Himalayas. China had all these roads, and they built a railroad into Tibet, which was a first, and India had nothing. So now Indians are scrambling to build roads, put in airfields and what have you, because the Chinese, again, without any fanfare, you got to watch the Chinese, they'll just quietly go about their business. They had built the ability to put a large military force over the border into this basically, thinly populated jungle, hilly jungle in the northeast India. And basically take it, and India was not prepared to defend it. So that's why the Indians are nervous about China.
Now, Austin, India has a number of political issues, right, on their borders and with internally.
Well, they've got tons of them. Let me make a quick comment about what Jim was saying about the Indian Ocean. The struggle. Or right now it's kind of shadow boxing, I should say, but it's between India and China. Look, one of the ironies about the International Anti-Piracy Patrol that Jim mentioned, India participates in that as well, or at least it has, and it's had scored some significant successes against pirates, primarily along the Somali coast. But remember that some of these Somali pirates were even operating deeper in the Indian Ocean. As I recall, one of the more spectacular operations against the pirates was actually carried out 1,500 kilometers, I think, Jim, or more in the Indian Ocean. It was by an Indian naval vessel. So there's some cooperation going on as well. And just take a look at the map, Dan. I mean, India is this huge triangle. It's the tiger's tooth that sticks down into the middle of the Indian Ocean. It's called the Indian Ocean for an obvious reasons. And the Indian Navy, I mean, Jim has sketched out some of the growth of the Chinese Navy and Chinese interests and the like, but the Indian Navy is a it's got more than just coastal reach, and China and Southwest Asia are absolutely critical to Africa and Southwest Asia are critical to the Chinese economy. And as Jim said, hey, that's the line of communication. That's the line of trade coming from Africa and Southwest Asia through the Indian Ocean and then through the Straits of Malacca or one of the other straits in the Pacific and then up into the South China Sea. So it's very important to China to have for the shipping and have really free access that it's shipping through the Indian Ocean. It's very important economically, and therefore it's very important politically. Now, as for India's multitude of issues. This is something that we cover. There are things that we tend to focus on more. I mean, heavens, Pakistan and India conflict. We've been writing about that from the get-go with a Quick and Dirty Guide to War series. And that's, I think, you can go back in the files we've got on Strategy Page over the last 14 years and get a highly granular appreciation of the not just the quote unquote state to state conflict, but tribe says something about it, but it's more complex than that. regional, ethnic and religious conflicts along the border areas between India and Pakistan, and of course some of the religious issues in India are you've got a variety of it's not just a clash of Hindu versus Muslim, even though that is one primary frame, and that's the common frame that you get globally and certainly see in the West. There are various Hindu groups, or groups like the Sikhs, that don't fit into either category. And you've got, the thing is with the caste system no longer exists, Dan, except the Indians will tell you, yeah, in certain ways it does. And there's a socioeconomic reality to it. Socioeconomic reality becomes a political reality. So that feeds some of the regional issues that India faces as well. And some of these, it's not that there are rebellions, but you will see strikes, wildcat strikes, riots, and the like. These are sub-conflicts, but they are a problem that the Indian government struggles with constantly, because they are the source of one thing they want to avoid, and here I'm going to jump to a specific, is the Tamils down in Tamil Nadu, Nadu state. They don't want to have a Tamil rebellion, and one of the things that India was terribly concerned about in Sri Lanka was the Tamil conflict on Sri Lanka spreading to South India. It didn't happen. As a matter of fact, the number of the Tamil leaders in South India worked with the Indian government, says we've got to end this because we don't want their kind of radicalism upsetting our state and inflicting that kind of bringing war to our state. That's the way I would want to work it. But part of the reason the leadership there was concerned about it is because some of these socioeconomic issues and the ethnic issues are problems that could be exacerbated by rebels and agitators. Now, I'll let Jim talk about Assam because he writes about the little continual tribal rebellions that afflict northeastern India, and certainly the ongoing Maoist rebellion in the east. These are just some of the troubles that India confronts. Here's the strength about it, though. China is riven by regional conflicts as well, Dan. It's riven by linguistic conflicts, somewhat in the same way India is, but because the dialectical differences between the South and Guangdong and the North, let's say Beijing, it's quite real. And whether they speak on Taiwan, the Chinese on Taiwan, no, they speak Cantonese, Guangdongese. So these exist in China as well, but the Communist Party tried to put a lid on it. India has no real lid because it has really a comparatively to other in the region, a free press, so everybody knows about it and everybody talks about it. And though for the diversity that I've described and the linguistic diversity in India, here's something that has been noticeable over the last 30 years. Yes, at one time, the Indian leadership and the senior members of the Congress Party, they were all very anti-British. They hated the British. The British had been the imperialists, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they were going to make Hindi, I believe, the official language, and not English. And Hindi is actually a quote-unquote official language. However, there are lots of regions that don't speak Hindi, in India. Plenty of their people have learned it and speak it, but they all spoke English. That was the common language. And now a number of Indians have realized this is an economic and political strength, that we do have English as a common language, and it quickly ties us to the global economy, where the U.S. is still the world leader. Take a look at, you know, the Bangalore phenomenon, and the fact that outsourcing of computer software problems to India, because people could talk to you here, you know, in the U.S. and Canada. So here, for all the negative that I brought up, India faces up to its, or at least it recognizes its problems, and it tries to mitigate them. It tries to mitigate them. Whether it is whether it is the tortoise in this race with China, and China's the hare, and that's the way it's set up symbolically, because India's dragging a lot of load, but it's dragging it in public, and it does have some. India's got some allies. India's got some allies that they can rely on, and though that initial cadre of the revolutionary cadre of the Congress Party was anti-British, and they would say with good reason. Take a look, and Jim can speak to this, who the Indian military trains with: Singapore and Australia. First of all, former British colonies. Who do they don't have that relationship with the United States yet, but in their competition with China, who is an available large and capable ally? Well, that would be the United States. And the Indians are aware of this. So they've got an American card. They've got an American card, or a U.S. card, as they see it. They don't tout it. In fact, as you'll just see the opposite said in many in Indian newspapers. But they're aware of it. And the Chinese are aware of it as well. I'd be interested in hearing Jim's comment on that.
The Indian orientation has always been towards the West in terms of military affairs. Although they worked with Russia in terms of buying equipment for a long time, they always maintained their Western habits of training. So basically, they had more effective training. They have, since the end of the Cold War, since the 1990s, they have grown even closer to the West. Again, as Austin pointed out, they haven't exactly gotten in bed with the United States yet, but there has been more interaction between the American and Indian military, and the Indians have become very cozy with Israel. Now, this is primarily on counterterrorism matters, but they have also been buying Israeli infantry, you know, and combat equipment, and bringing in Israeli advisors. So India basically has a more effective attitude, doctrine, training, and leadership policy than China. Chinese are aware of this, and the Chinese are basically playing catch-up. But man for man at the moment, the Indians are probably ahead. But again, as I keep pointing out, the Chinese are, you know, making incremental progress every year. And this is what has got the Indians worried, because unlike, you know, Europe and the United States, where China is sort of, you know, something possibly bad that's happening far, far away, China's right next door to India, and the Indians have never gotten over that little trauma they had back in 1963 when they fought a brief border war, again, on the Tibetan frontier, and lost. And they've never really, you know, gotten over that. And they're afraid that the Chinese have not gotten over it either and will make another grab on the border if they're not careful. So this tension is there. But there's also an arms race and a capability race going on with the two countries. And it's not likely to stop anytime soon.
Yeah. Austin, one last question.
we know that we've got the border issues with China where they could come into conflict and that India could come in conflict with China and the Indian Ocean. Is there also other areas where they could come into conflict over resources or economically?
Oh, the answer to that is yes, and how they're aware of that as well. There are also places they could cooperate too. I mean, India and China is not an inevitable conflict, and certainly the wiser leaders in Beijing and Delhi understand that. Southeast Asia is a area of some certainly they've both got political and economic interests in Southeast Asia. Here's something. Let me sketch something that is. I think there's evidence for what I'm saying, Dan, but some of this is also speculative. You look at the ASEAN nations, associated Southeast Asian nations, and that's Vietnam, Thailand, Cambodia, Malaysia, and the like. And Vietnam has a direct the Vietnamese Chinese relationship is to describe it as strained is probably that's probably accurate. The thing is, it could get worse very, very quickly. And Vietnam is looking for allies. It's developing a quasi alliance with South Korea, and because of South Korea's interests in its own security as well. The Philippines are part of ASEAN, and you know the difference, the problems the Philippines and Vietnam have had with China over the claims in the South China Sea. And Jim and I have both written extensively about this. Southeast Asia. Well, they look for support, and India looks like a potential ally. The U.S. Navy is the preferred ally by the Philippines, and I think by the Vietnamese as well, and even the Malaysians, because of meaning the United States, but the U.S. naval forces are superb, and they are a counter. They're a political counterweight and a military counterweight to Chinese operations and Chinese intrusion from the Filipino perspective into the South China Sea. But India is another potential big ally. So that makes Southeast Asia, and when you bring Singapore into this, I already said Singapore is functionally an ally of India. You bring Singapore into it, Singapore sits on the Straits of Malacca. Now, there are a couple. There's the Sunda Strait over there, and then you can go down. What's the other one, Jim? Lompur or Lompak? I forget the name, but I know the Sunda Strait, of course. But those are the ways, the Straits of Malacca, those are the ways you connect the Indian Ocean to the Pacific, and that's where all this tanker and freighter and container ship traffic that China relies on, they move through those straits, through those bottlenecks. And the Strait of Malacca is the key strait there, and you already have an Indian ally there. Now, Singapore wants to make money because it's 75-80% Chinese, ethnic Chinese itself. They want to have good relationships with the People's Republic, but they have no illusions about what the People's Republic is currently and the Chinese Communist Party. So there's the Straits of Malacca, which is at the bottom. You know, it's India. Indonesia is functionally part of Southeast Asia as well. I mean, Sumatra and the like. Borneo certainly is, and Borneo is split between Malaysia and Indonesia. There's a zone of conflict right there, and it's a fragmented one, Dan, but it's a volatile one. It comes back to some of the things that Jim was talking about when we began the discussion, though, the connectivity to resource bases in Southwest Asia and Africa. But it also has to do with Chinese perception of Chinese expansionism, and attempts to exert hegemony. That's one of the phrases that you'll see crop up in Southeast Asia and the South China Sea. And that brings India in. And India is already concerned about Burma, which is, as Jim points out, in some ways is kind of a Jim, would you call him an ally or a subsidiary? I don't know. They have a Burma-Myanmar relationship with the People's Republic.
They have a complicated relationship. The connections with China are fraying at the moment, and India is trying to become the principal ally.
All right. See, well, that's on the border, and you wanted to move past the border, but you see, you move through Burma, and then you're into Thailand. So there you go, Dan.
Okay. Well, it's going to be interesting to continue to watch this race between China and India. We have in the past, and like you said, we've got stuff going back 14 years watching what's going on there. So we're a great source of information here. Thank you, and we'll talk to you
next time. Take care, guys. Bye.